Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Good music is what we want to hear.
What do you mean, good music?
It's what we dance to, what our children will dance to. And if you don't want to play it, and take your records and go home.
Did you have a band? Good or bad?
It's a great band. It's a bad band. It's like pizza, baby. It's good no matter what. There's music in the air.
Welcome to Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media. I'm Jim DeRogatis, the pop music critic at the Chicago Sun-Times.
And I'm Greg Cott. I write about rock and roll for the Chicago Tribune. Today on the world's only rock and roll talk show, Jim and I welcome musical collaborators Zooey Deschanel and M. Ward of She and Him.
Plus, we'll review the long-awaited comeback attempt by Whitney Houston and the latest from Brit buzz band The Arctic Monkeys.
Support for Sound Opinions is provided by founding sponsor Alltech Lansing and their new mixed speaker system, the next generation boombox for iPhone and iPod. Online at alltechlansing.com.
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and time now for some music news.
Greg, we said it the very first time we talked about Michael Jackson's death. This is going to be a story that goes on, and it has not disappointed us in terms of the shocking twists and turns that it seems to take every other day. This latest one is a bombshell. The Associated Press has reported that the Los Angeles County coroner has ruled Jackson's death a homicide, that he was killed by the combination of drugs he had taken. As of this taping, they haven't officially said that, but the AP seems to have really good sources in the coroner's office. A homicide doesn't mean he was necessarily murdered, but it does pave the way for criminal charges to be brought in case the Los Angeles officials go in that direction. And the man they're looking at is Dr. Conrad Murray, who could be subject to a manslaughter investigation, that it was not an intentional murder of Jackson, but he contributed to his death by administering these drugs. Michael seemed to have trouble sleeping quite a lot, and Murray was on board to drug him in order for him to get some sleep. Some of the drugs that he took, were fairly common, Valium, lorazepam, but the drug that seems to have combined with those and contributed to his death was called propofol, which Jackson called his milk. When he really had trouble sleeping, he asked for his milk. This was a milky white drug that most commonly was injected into people to knock them out heavy duty for surgery. This is not a sleeping pill, okay? The question involved in this story is one of the timeline. At what point did Dr. Murray inject the drugs? At what point did he realize that Jackson stopped breathing? At what point were the paramedics called in? There's two different timelines. Dr. Murray's makes it all seem as if it happened fairly quickly. My patient is not breathing. He calls the ambulance. The other timeline that comes from interviews with people who were in the household puts it at an hour's delay between administering the drugs, realizing Jackson wasn't breathing, and then calling the paramedics in, during which time apparently Dr. Murray made a lot of personal phone calls on his cell phone.
Bizarre, Jim. It's very bizarre. And as we continue the debate over who did or did not kill Michael Jackson, they keep selling him.
Yeah.
It's amazing how this just happens. Court ruling in Los Angeles a few days ago, basically allowing AEG, who was to promote that 50-concert comeback by Jackson at the O2 Arena in London, is now going to oversee the sale of part of his estate. There's going to be a memorabilia sale at that O2 Arena starting in late October to coincide with the release of a movie that is also going to look behind the scenes of those rehearsals for that comeback tour. So AEG is going to start making money off of the Jackson estate very quickly. The estate is going to be splitting these profits halfway. It's 50-50. They expect to make at least $6 million alone from the memorabilia sale.
Well, they had a considerable amount of money invested in Jackson's comeback, the Anschutz Entertainment Group.
Yes, they did. So it appears that they're going to start making some of it back very quickly starting in October. In addition, the five surviving Jackson brothers, Jermaine, Jackie, Marlon, Randy, and Tito, are going to star in, get this, a reality TV series.
Wow.
On A&E.
This is not a good idea.
Not a good idea, but apparently they started filming this in January with the anticipation that there was going to be this tour, this comeback. Now it's going to be a full-blown series. One of the producers of the series says, to anybody that says the family is capitalizing on Michael's death, it will be evident in the first episode that this is not true.
Well, I'm sure that there's fascinating things that Tito Jackson does every day just to pass the time.
Whenever you're near, I hear a symphony, a tender melody, pulling me closer, closer to your arms. Then suddenly,
Greg, here's some good news. New research from Northwestern University says that if you hear a symphony, like the Supremes, or any music, you may actually be training your brain and your ears to pick out speech patterns from complicated, noisy backgrounds. People who start, especially at an early age, either playing an instrument themselves or listening to a lot of music, have an easier time later in life as they grow older in situations like a crowded restaurant or a train, being able to hear other people's speech, which can be difficult sometimes. You know, we know this. I think we're both losing our hearing sometimes. But now it's saying, you know, hey, all those years when mom told you that you better turn down that racket, actually, you may have been doing yourself some good in training your brain and your ear to process sound.
That is Oh What a Night, one of the great doo-wop songs out of Chicago. The 1969 version was actually hit twice, in the 50s for the Dells and then again in 1969, the remake. The reason we're playing it is one of the vocalists on that track, Johnny Carter, died recently at the age of 75, one of the last living links to a great era of singing, doo-wop, and the kernels, the groundwork for soul music of the 60s and 70s was laid by these doo-wop groups out of Chicago in the 50s. We're talking about groups like the Dells and the Flamingos, of which Carter was a part, as well as the Spaniels, the Moonglows, the Eldorados. Great groups all, some of the most romantic music ever made. The music of the Southern Church, the gospel music of the Southern Church, transferred to the street corners and singing about romantic love in a way that I still think hasn't been equaled. Carter was a key part of that movement. As I said, he sang in not only the Dells, but the Flamingos, which was one of the great groups of the early 50s. And one of his great moments that we'll play in tribute to Johnny Carter, dead at the age of 75, is his song, Golden Teardrops, on which he sings the lead vocals. Here it is on Sound Opinions.
Golden teardrops, from the eyes of my love, you make me reconsider what a fool I've been.
not my memories. The reason you came was because of me. You made me sit right down and add up the scores. So go back
where you came from. She won't need you anymore.
I never realized that I was unfair to a love that was really sincere. I never knew how much you really cared. So in a crowded room, or busy street, or a cottage by the sea. But until the end of time, and throughout eternity, I'll remember.
As you said,
those golden tears drop.
That was Golden Teardrops from the Flamingos in honor of Johnny Carter. Listening to Sound Opinions, and that is a song called Why Do You Let Me Stay Here by the duo She and Him. Who are She and Him? Matt Ward is well-known in the underground rock world, great singer and songwriter in the folky vein. For this project, She and Him, he teamed up with singer Zooey Deschanel, who up until now is really best known as an actress, starring in the film 500 Days of Summer. She's been in Elf, she's been in Almost Famous. We had M. Ward and Zooey Deschanel come into the studio last year as they were promoting their debut album, Volume 1. Greg Kot and I are here with She and Him, Matt Ward and Zooey Deschanel. Welcome to Sound Opinions, guys.
Thank you.
Nice to be here.
Let's start at the very beginning of how this collaboration began. It's probably a story you're sick and tired of telling. But you were working on a soundtrack for film, and Zooey, you were in the film, and then you got put together.
The director of the film, a gentleman named Martin Hines, he asked us to do a duet for the soundtrack, for the end credits. And so we got together to record it, and it was really fun.
So this is the movie The Go-Getter.
Yes.
What, did he know you could sing?
Yeah. No, he knew I was a singer. I've been a singer for since I was a child, and he thought we would sound good together. And I'm not sure if it was Martin. Maybe Martin told you that I had a bunch of songs. Was it Martin? Or did I tell you? Can't remember.
I thought you told me about.
Yeah. Well, I had been
going
rating
back a few years now.
Yeah, it was a while ago.
And you two didn't know each other before then, or?
No. I mean, I was a big fan of Matt, and I was sort of secretly writing all this music, and I had just like tons of music, and I recorded these little baby demos of them in the kind of in my bedroom, and somehow I got up the courage to send them to Matt.
So Zooey, you can say definitively you had M. Ward albums in your collection.
Oh yeah.
And Matt, had you seen any of Zooey's films?
I've seen Elf, and I knew she was a great singer, and I remember thinking that she was a singer and also an actress. Like, maybe she already had records or something, and I was surprised to find out that she didn't have any.
And the story goes, Zoe, that you've been writing songs since, like, you were 8 years old or something like that. Yeah. Is that true? And recording them, actually? Or?
Well, I started writing when I was about eight, but I started recording music as soon as the M-Box came out, which is like a portable Pro Tools thing. Maybe it wasn't as soon as it came out, but I got one in like 2002 or something, and I had all these songs, so I just like started recording all these songs and becoming a little bit obsessed with it. And then I just had all these songs like in my computer that I'd written that I wasn't doing anything with, and then they just started piling up and piling up, and I kept thinking to myself, like, I have to do something with these, but I didn't know of a situation where I felt they would be properly represented. I only wanted to put them in the world if they were going to be, you know, well taken care of. So
right. You didn't want to just float them on the net.
Yeah, and I didn't want to just record them with any person. I kind of knew that it would take somebody very special to be able to produce this music and keep the spirit of it and also make it sound really good. And so as soon as I met Matt, I was like, that's the guy to if I get the chance, like praying that he would like the songs, because of, you know, that was like, that's the guy.
That's cool. We're going to pick up the story, but let's hear a song first. Okay. What are we going to hear, man? What's up?
Take It Back, a song from the record that Zoe wrote.
Cool. That's Zoe Deschanel and M. Ward of She and Him performing their song Take It Back. When we return after a short break on Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media, we're going to continue our conversation with the band, and later we're going to review new albums from pop diva Whitney Houston and UK rockers The Arctic Monkeys.
I'm all out of luck, but what else? he's yours and he'll never belong to me again. I did him wrong, so don't brag, keep it to yourself. I did him wrong. I was never nice, never nice, never enough, but I can try, I can try to toughen up. I listened when they told me, if it burns you let him go, change his heart, I should know.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media. You're hearing a little bit of the She and Him song, Take It Back. The duo performed that song for us live when they were here with us last year, and it's one of many songs on their album Volume 1 where you can hear the influence of jazz cabaret. I asked actress and songwriter Zooey Deschanel about her love of this genre. So Zooey, you've got this sort of other side of your life. People know you best from the movie world, but you've been playing in this jazz cabaret project, right? And it, that sounded like it may have come out of that experience a little bit, that particular song, or?
Yeah, I mean, just singing standards for years. I love, you know, Cole Porter and Gershwin and Rodgers and Hart and a lot of these great old songwriters. And I think definitely that song, I drew a lot of inspiration from those songwriters.
Well, that raises a question, Zooey. I mean, in Almost Famous, we were talking before about Cameron Crowe.
I knew you were going to bring this up.
Well, Cameron Crowe's a friend of mine, and you know, I know a lot about what he put into making that movie.
Yeah.
And you really got, after Philip Seymour Hoffman playing his mentor, Lester Bangs, you got the role I think that was near and dearest to his heart.
One day, you'll be cool. Look under your bed. It'll set you free.
You're the sister who gives this kid the key to unlock his future in the movie with those albums,
right,
okay?
Right.
This record will change your life. Who in both of your lives, Matt and Zooey, did that for you? How do you find Gershwin and Cole Porter or whatever it is that first made you fall in love with music, each of you?
Well, I think for me, like, it was a succession of different artists. I mean, when I was a little girl, my mom had three tapes that she'd play in the car. It was Linda Ronstadt, a record called Heart Like a Wheel, and then the Everly Brothers, and Love and Spoonful. So, like, those three artists are, like, just burned in my brain. And then my parents were also always playing Bob Dylan. I mean, this sounds so obvious, but I saw Hard Day's Night when I was, like, 9, and I couldn't believe the way the music made me feel. It was like I watched it every day, I think, for like months. Like, whenever I was allowed to watch a movie, I was like, A Hard Day's Night. And then I think I was a little bit older when I sort of discovered the standards. It was through listening to Ella Fitzgerald records and Nina Simone in high school.
Matt, what about you? What was that moment that you had this explosion that said, yes, this is my life?
I don't know if I never really wanted to do this for a living, but there's definitely records that made me feel like it would be a good life, or maybe it would be a worthy way to make a living, and hopefully a dignified way of making a living. And that, I guess, probably if I had to pick one, it would be listening to Johnny Cash records that my dad played in the car, and and then later discovering this guitar player, John Fahey, and between those two guys, that covers a lot of ground.
Yeah, that's for sure. You know, it's interesting, too. The aesthetic that you're talking about here comes across in the way this record sounds, She and Him Volume 1. But the whole idea of it doesn't have a fixed sense of time about it in terms of, well, God, that sounds like a 2007 drum sound on that record, or that sounds like a 1986 synthesizer. This record doesn't sound like a lot of stuff that's out there right now. It sounds like it could have been made in any era. It doesn't have a fixed stamp date on it. Was that something that you were going for when you recorded the record?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, we're both, I think, bigger fans of recordings, analog recordings, than most digital recordings. And we referenced, and I've been borrowing production ideas from older records since I started making records. And it's a fun challenge to borrow production ideas with respect to the geniuses that discovered them. And hopefully, yeah, I think having a record live in a place and time that's not specifically distinct is to its benefit.
It's one of those things where, do you think about things like this when you're recording, Zoe? That, well, obviously this is first kind of coming out party for you as a recording artist, but it seems like this is the kind of record you could put on 20 years from now, and it's not going to sound,
I mean,
hokey. You know what I mean?
It was all in the moment. It was very, really fun experience because everything that happened was of the moment, and it came out of just the spirit of making music, and it was very organic. And we recorded it on tape, and we tried to use mostly, real things as much as we, as in, they're in the room, they're not digital. But we weren't tethered by that idea. We didn't feel like, oh, if we wanted to do something digital, we'd be, no, we made this rule. We weren't rule bound, but pretty much that's just where the tastes lay. So,
well, and the irony of recording it that way for the final version of Volume 1 is that as you were working on them, I mean, Zoe, you were in Los Angeles, you're writing these songs, you're sending Matt your recordings up in Portland.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
via email,
all my demos, I mean, I recorded, what's funny is that all of my demos I recorded on GarageBand and on the Pro Tools. So, I have to say, if it weren't for digital technology, I wouldn't, being able to play with harmony is one of the things that I love most about making music, and I just wouldn't be able to do that. I might, but it would just be a lot, if it weren't for Les Paul,
Yeah, there you go. It all starts there.
Yeah.
I think that the most hilarious thing is that the we put a little sort of hidden track in the end of the record of Swing Low Sweet Chariot that I recorded all vocals on GarageBand, on my computer, in the middle of the night.
Swing low, sweet chariot, come for to carry me home. Swing low, sweet.
And we had it mastered, and it sounds like it's from, because it's all hissy. It's like the thing that sounds the most old is the one that's
the most
digital.
The most new, right.
Yeah, right.
Why don't you give us another song, and if you can, illustrate a little bit about how that email back and forth went.
I think I sent them... I sent them to Matt, and it was a week before I actually heard back, and I was like, I hope he likes them, and then I'm like, if he doesn't like them, it's totally cool, I'll figure out something else.
What were you doing in that week?
I think he was on vacation or something.
I don't check my email that much.
She's hanging on
the other end, and you're don't check in your email.
Right.
Wow.
You're like, I was on vacation. I was like, oh, that's really cool. Whatever.
Why don't you give us another song?
Okay. Should we do which one? Smokey Robinson song? Sure. We're going to do a cover that we put on the record. I don't like you, but I love you. Seems that I'm always thinking of you. Oh, you treat me badly. I love you madly. You really got a hold on me.
You really got a hold on me.
Said you really got a hold on me.
You really got a hold on me.
I don't want you, but I need you. Don't want to kiss you, but I need to. Oh, you do. My love's strong now. You really got a hold on me.
You really got a hold on me.
Said you really got a hold on me.
You really got a hold on me.
I love you
and all I want you to do is just hold me, hold me, hold me, hold me.
I wanna leave you, don't wanna stay here, don't wanna spend another day. Oh, 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 you do me wrong now. My love is strong now. You really got a hold on
you
me.
You really got a hold on me.
Said you really got a hold on me.
You really got a hold.
Ward and Zoe Deschanel, She and Him, with a song that Smokey Robinson made famous. Now, it takes guts to cover a song that's that well-known, that classic, and try to put your own stamp on it.
It's a great song.
It is a great song. I don't think we even thought about guts.
Just we love this song. Let's celebrate this song.
You know, the sentiments expressed in there are so complex. It's such a simple song, and yet it's a very complex song. You know,
yeah.
You love somebody, but you don't like them.
Yeah.
Which is like, that's deep. I think it's just a deep line, you know?
That's like my favorite. I mean, it's my favorite songwriting is songwriting that can make something that is very complex, you know, can distill it into one line. I don't like you, but I love you. I mean, that's like that's a brilliant line.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Obviously, a model for your songwriting. I mean, this kind of thing. You mentioned Cole Porter, Smokey Robinson, Gershwin, all these people, these classic songwriters. I mean, and that can be daunting, too. Like, I'm measuring myself not against necessarily
contemporary pop artists, but, right. you know, these classic...
It was never like, oh, I'm going to write the song and it's going to be as good as this. It's just, I guess you always just, you know, have these things in the back of your mind as you can't stop yourself all the time. You just have to express yourself. And I think of songwriting as telling stories and expressing myself and in a way that is pleasing to my sensibilities. And then I try not to think too much about it other than mm-hmm. that.
Yeah, you can't, I guess, you know, otherwise you'd stop dead in your tracks. Now, speaking of daunting challenges, the other issue that faces something like this, Zoe, is that, you know, obviously there's a certain cachet attached with your name, and you could have had, you know, Timbaland produce the record and, you know, competed in that marketplace. You know, and the flip side of that is that there's a certain element of the buying public that's very skeptical about, you know, somebody from Hollywood, somebody who's been in movies doing a record. You know,
sure. They think everybody has to be in a box. Yeah. You know, she has to be in the actress box, and Matt over here has to be in the indie rock box.
Yeah.
You know, we don't want you. What are you covering Smokey Robinson for, dude? You know, now if you wanted to cover, you know, Who's Who, right. that'd be fine. But what do you? To what extent have both of you fought to get out of those boxes?
I mean. It's just sort of the society in which we live. It's a reflection of that, you know, everyone does sort of get put in boxes. But I think that if you don't take those boxes seriously, because they're being an actor, it doesn't mean that you'd be a good singer or a good songwriter, but it doesn't mean you wouldn't be either.
No, we've heard Paris Hilton and Lindsay Lohan's albums. Yow.
Yeah, I mean, so it doesn't mean you're good or bad. And it's like this I think of as a separate career. It's like I'm a different person in this arena. It's like part of the problem is as an actor, you have a name that's attached to you, the person that is also the name of this product that you are, which is like this profession that you have, this sort of, it's like you're a product. And then I, as a person, I am a different thing. Zooey Deschanel, the person, is mm-hmm. different from Zooey Deschanel, the actor. And so, it was important to me to have a different name on the project because I kind of, you know, wanted some separation between the two.
Well, and it's there in the very anonymity of the way you name this project. Right. She and him and her. Us and them. What about Matt? I mean, were you worried from the indie rock backlash of M. Ward? What are you doing making a record with a Hollywood starlet?
I've never been worried about it because the first thing I heard was the songs, and I knew the songs could stand up on their own, and that it's as simple as that.
Content is king, as they say. She's got the goods. It's about this music.
That's the way that's the way I saw it initially.
Zooey Deschanel, M. Ward, She and Him on Sound Opinions. It has really been a pleasure to have you guys here. Thank you.
Thank you for having
Thanks
us.
Thanks for having us.
For those of you who tried but didn't make it, settle down, it's never.
To hear more She and Him songs, visit soundopinions.org. And to make a comment on the air, call our hotline, 888-859-1800. Jim and I are going to be back after a short break on Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media with reviews of new albums from Whitney Houston and the Arctic Monkeys.
For those of you who thought you'd be forgotten, the friends you've made will try their best to make. So think of all the beauty that you left behind you. You can take it if you want it, and then let it go. And this is not a test. No, this is not.
Support for Sound Opinions is provided by founding sponsor Alltech Lansing and their new mixed speaker system, the next generation boombox for iPhone and iPod. Online at alltechlansing.com.
Winter storms have come, and darkened my sun. After all that I've been through, who on earth can I turn to? I look to you.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media. That is the title track, I Look to You, of the eagerly awaited, long-time-in-the-making new album by Whitney Houston. Greg, there is a whole generation now of pop and R&B fans who know Whitney Houston primarily from reality television, being Bobby Brown, which shared her troubled home life with the world. She finally divorced Brown in 2007, but not before a series of headlines, rather tawdry headlines. She was busted for pot in Hawaii. She canceled at the last minute an appearance at the Academy Awards. There were heavy-duty rumors out there that The Voice, that was her nickname, The Voice, had been ruined by substance abuse. Now, post-rehab, post-reconnecting with her faith, post-Brown, Whitney is trying to rebuild her career. This album was originally supposed to come out in late 2007, a long time in the making, overseen by the man who first took her out of the gospel church and her roots in Newark, New Jersey, and made her a superstar, Clive Davis. It was an extraordinary career. I mean, that record-breaking string of multi-platinum hits and the 93 cover of Dolly Parton's I Will Always Love You, still one of the biggest-selling singles of all time. Mm-hmm. The question is, people think Whitney Houston, and you might as well be telling people a Monica Lewinsky joke. It's a little bit dated at this point. You know what I mean? In the new millennium, 7 years since she's made a record, could she pull it off? Clive Davis put her in the studio and kept her there, as I said, for 2 years with a superstar roster of songwriters and producers. That track we heard on the way in was produced by R. Kelly. He helms two songs on this record. Other names include Swizz Beatz, Alicia Keys, Akon, Stargate, Diane Warren, David Foster, the best talent money can buy. What does it all add up to? We'll give our thoughts and grade the album on the Buy It, Burn It, Trash It scale when we come back. But let's play the opening track first. Give it a listen. This is Million Dollar Bill by Whitney Houston from I Look to You on Sound Opinions.
Whitney Houston with a track called Million Dollar Bill from her sixth album, I Look to You, and first in 7 years, as Jim pointed out. I love that track. The production on there by Alicia Keys and Swizz Beatz, I think, is exactly
what Whitney Houston needs. I like her when she gets a little frisky, you know? It often feels to me like she's straitjacketed on her albums.
Yeah.
She is a great singer, a great voice, who has never made a great album. That is a great track, and I think it exemplifies what I would hope that Whitney Houston would do more often. Unfortunately, the rest of the album for me is a real letdown after that fine opening track that almost swings a little bit. Again, she is put into these straitjacketed pop songs, these straitjacketed pop production ideas, overseen, it must be pointed out, by Clive Davis, who has been her mentor and executive producer since day one, with a host of big names. There's the R. Kellys, the Diane Warrens, the Akons, the Stargates, the David Fosters. None of these producers bringing anything really new to the table. It needs to be said, how does Diane Warren get work?
I don't understand
time?
It.
Yeah. Time after time, she serves up this cookie-cutter, big schlock power ballad that Houston, even she can't seem to get her hands around, it because there's not a hint of humanity or personality in it.
I didn't know my own strength, and I crashed down, and I tumbled, but I did not crumble. I got through all the pain. I didn't know my own strength, survived my darkest hour. My faith kept me alive. I took myself back up.
So, as a result, Houston sounds, again, somewhat robotic on this record, like she's being plugged in, just a pretty ornament on these modern production tracks. The one exception is she got one great song here. Leon Russell's A Song for You is a undeniably great song that those Stargate guys, that Swedish production team, screwed up by turning it into a disco track about halfway through. I go,
it's not a disco.
They kind of
lean toward old school Chicago house. I kind of like that track. Look, I am shocked overall that I do not despise this record, because I hated Whitney Houston's records in the 90s. Clive Davis wrapped her in these big, fluffy, smothering pillows of sound.
Yeah.
And I got to say that for the most part here, despite all those monumental, very expensive egos in the kitchen, this record is not overcooked. The Kelly tracks in particular pare things down to just, you know, spare rhythm section and grand piano. And I think pretty much from start to finish, except for when Akon, you know, the master of auto-tune, lends his vocals in a duet with Whitney, who actually can sing, I think that it's all about keeping the focus on her voice. The voice is still powerful. It's full of emotion. It's singing lyrics that are really corny. Every single song on this record, including the Leon Russell tune, are about, you know, I've been through hard times, I found my faith, I did prevail, all right? You know, it's like, okay, but I figured that would be a given. She doesn't go into the higher octave, you know, register that makes your ears bleed anymore. When she does go high, she does it kind of gently instead of, you know, bravura virtuoso.
Mm-hmm.
I'm surprised that this record doesn't stink. You know, it's really pretty pleasant. So on a buy it, burn it, trash it scale, not that Whitney Houston needs anyone's money, I think it's a buy it record.
I think you gotta have that track Million Dollar Bill, and I would trash the rest.
If you can summon the strength, tell me I can't hold down the urgency. You've got to make your descent.
That's a song from the new Arctic Monkeys album Humbug called My Propeller, with Alex Turner on those coy lead vocals. Turner was a teenager when he turned the English pop scene upside down in 2005 with a series of tracks on the Arctic Monkeys website that were spread all over the internet and made this band a huge sensation before their first album even came out. They were selling out shows, their songs were being sung out loud in the streets of London, and created the fastest-selling debut album in the history of UK pop with Whatever People Say I Am, That's What I'm Not in 2006. If you remember that album at all, you will remember it for that single, I Bet You Look Good on the Dance Floor. Big hit in Europe and the UK, less so in the US, but certainly made their mark here as well. They followed it up quickly in 2007 with an album called Favorite Worst Nightmare, an album that did slightly less well in the U.S., and some of the buzz wore off a bit. So they took a couple of years off. They went into the California desert with an unlikely choice for a producer for album number three, Josh Homme of Queens of the Stone Age, an unlikely pairing that resulted in the new album called Humbug. Let's hear how the collaboration with Homme, famous for that desert rock stoner metal sound with Queens of the Stone Age, turned out. Here's a track from the new album called Crying Lightning on Sound Opinions.
Said you're mistaken if you're thinking that I haven't been caught cold before. As you bit into your strawberry lace, then offered your attention in the form of a gobstopper. It's all you had left and it was going to waste. Your pastimes consisted of the strange and twisted and deranged, and I loved that little game you had called crying lightning, and how you like to aggravate the ice cream man on rainy afternoons.
That is Crying Lightning by Arctic Monkeys on Sound Opinions from their third album, Humbug. And boy, do I love that track. It exemplifies everything that is great about this record. The decadence, the wit. There's that tom-heavy groove. It's hitting you like Sunday morning's hangover. There's that Snake Charmer guitar line. And then there's Turner coming in with these wonderful... You know, he's a graduate, Greg, of the UK School of Sociological Lyricists, started by, you know, Ray Davies and furthered by Morrissey and Brian Ferry.
Right.
You know, he's talking about meeting this Lolita like lass who puffs out her chest like she'd never lost a war. And you know it's going to be bad for him, but he's going to get involved and he's going to regret it. This is an album about going down dark alleys. It's very Lou Reed in that way. It's very much inspired by what I would call the warlock soul of Nick Cave or Scott Walker. It's a real departure for these guys. They were all about that Britpop and dance punk buzz, and now they're doing something different. I applaud them for it. It shows that they have depth. I love this album. This is an album to just sit at home in your dark cave and groove to. And I gotta say, it's a buy it record.
Well, I applaud them, too, for making the effort. They clearly needed a change of pace. I think they were in a similar position to bands like Franz Ferdinand and the Yeah Yeah Yeahs, who made second albums that were too similar to the first albums and needed to make a big change on album number three. The Yeah Yeah Yeahs succeeded more so than Franz Ferdinand, and now I would add Arctic Monkeys to that, you know, nice try, guys, but you didn't get all the way there category. I love the idea that they worked with Homme. It was a big risk. I love some of the dark tangents that he brought to the mix, but I don't think the songs are quite as strong. I think by far the strongest track on this record is one called Cornerstone that Homme actually didn't produce. It was done with their original producer, James Ford, back in New York.
I thought I saw you in the rusty hook, huddled up in a wicker chair. I wandered over for a closer look and kissed whoever was sitting there. She was close and she held me very tightly, till I asked awfully politely, please, can I call you her name?
Otherwise, I think those songs that hung together so well on that first Arctic Monkeys album aren't quite there on this record anymore. I love the melodies and the exuberance that this band had in those initial two records, and they've replaced it with texture and atmosphere on this particular record. And I hear what you're saying. Dark Night of the Soul, it's kind of got that gothic feel to it, but I would have wished for a little bit more variety. I wasn't expecting a mood record from these guys. I was expecting a few more great songs, and I didn't get them.
I think the problem are your expectations there, Mr. Codd. You're down on Whitney Houston. You're down on Arctic Monkeys. You're just in a foul mood.
I think Alex Turner is a great songwriter, and I applaud the experiment, but he didn't get there, and I'm going to have to give this a burning.
What do we have on the show next week?
Next week, Jim, in honor of Labor Day, we're going to do great work songs.
Greg, as always, we have some thank yous to say on the way out. She and Him were recorded by Sarah Toulouse, and our show was produced, as always, by our ace team of Todd Bachman, Jason Saldana, and Robin Lynn, with executive production and fearless leadership from Tori Southside Malatia, who, when I asked him if he agreed with you about that Whitney Houston review you just gave, said, "Hell to the no!"
Sound Opinions, everyone's a critic. So give us a call on our hotline,
1-888-859-1800.
Hello, this is Paul Simons from Levittown, Pennsylvania. I just want to say I really appreciated your appreciation of Les Paul, and I think that hearing that he likes Jeff Beck and Jeff Beck likes him, the thing those two guys have in common, as far as I can see, is that they're really very in the moment. They're never on autopilot. They're always wide awake to some new thing happening. And whether it's some kind of a run or a harmonic or a stop or an echo or just something that's unexpected, they're ready for the unexpected. Also, I want to say that Jesus Lizard, to me, played some great stuff. I like hearing stuff that I can't figure out just listening to it, that's got some difficulty to it, which they did. Oh, that's enough right there. That's enough right there. Keep up the good work. Thank you very much. Goodbye.
My name's Nick from Omaha, Nebraska. I just got done listening to the Interview in Life stuff with the Jesus Lizard. I believe they're one of the most underrated bands, and musically speaking, one of the most talented that lasted the longest.
Sits in a tub and relives the stories she never lived. It makes me feel blank. It makes me feel blank like I miss.
So talented, and the live shows are nothing short of what I would consider a modern-day Bacchus festival that you'd find in ancient Greece. Really enjoyed it. Have a good one.
Mary! 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 Mary!
Hi, my name is Dave Dorman from Minneapolis. Just wanted to thank you guys for having the Jesus Lizard on last night. Those guys are absolutely insane. They brought back a lot of good memories as I grew up a child of the 90s, especially the song Bloody Mary, which I remember picking up the CD. My grandma rolled into town that weekend, and I recall she fell down the stairs at about 4 in the morning, cracking her head open on a ping pong table. The pool of blood was terrible. To get along with the story, my folks rushed to the emergency room, and I had to clean up a pool of blood. And it kind of coagulates. It's really nasty, but the song Bloody Mary was in my head the whole time, and it was quite a surreal, disgusting experience. And I'm sure it didn't compare to anything of the carnage that Mr. Yao experienced on a most likely nightly basis. And thanks a lot. Bye.
Now I've been sitting on this abandoned beach for years, waiting for the salt to
wash. Hey, Jim and Greg, this is Dan from Waterloo, Iowa. You are reviewing the new Regina Spektor album, and Greg mentioned that he probably would never like to hear the song with the dolphin sound again. Well, I work at a clothing store that rhymes with gold gravy, and every day we play that song. So, if you're shopping for jeans, don't come into our store. Thank you. Bye.
Maybe one day you will understand that one.
No more messages.
To give us your opinion on sound opinions, call our hotline, 1-888-859-1800. We'll be back next week with sound opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media.